So we're starting to get into kind of a deep part of this series. So for those who might be new tonight, we're in this middle of this year-long series on what's called the Ox Herding Pictures. So it's a way of depicting the spiritual journey from start to finish, if you will. And it's, you know, it's depicted as a linear process, but it also has this kind of back and forth in reality, that we may open to one picture and then the next month be back into a previous picture, and it just kind of goes back and forth. But these images and these verses really help to kind of capture aspect of our practice. And this stage right now, we're on picture number, eight. And it's really a deep dharma. It's really the deepest part of our potential of our practice. And it's really the aim of Dharma practice is to move toward this depth and this kind of sense of realization toward awakening. And that being said, that may not be where your practice is or needs to be at this time. I think it's important to acknowledge that, to not try to force ourselves into something that we're not. Think, oh, I should be here and I'm really back here. It's actually very skillful to know that, to know where am I in my practice? What's appropriate? Should I be working on steadying my mind, trying to make contact with that breath, working with difficult emotions? Or should I start to open to the depth of stillness, the depth of emptiness? Now, it's interesting that the two traditions I'm most familiar with, this Western Vipassana and also the Zen tradition, have different emphasis, you know, in a very generalized way. Anytime you make a generalization, of course, there's lots of exceptions. But generally, you could say the Western Vipassana movement, you know, the way that Westerners have interpreted the teachings from Asia around the Insight tradition, the Theravadin tradition, it's very heavy on skillful means. You know, we have a lot of techniques of how to work with our minds, how to develop concentration, how to work with the hindrances. There's all these different ways. And of course, we've also added onto that our sophistication around psychological, mental health, all those aspects. So the tradition has really been formed and shaped around that. That's again a generalization. The other side of it, well, and also Western Vipassana really sometimes stays a little bit, maybe I want to say stuck is probably, might be not the best word, but it's a little bit like that. We stay a little bit in that mode of let's make ourselves better. Let's work on our minds. Let's work, learn to meet our experience. And we sometimes forget about the liberation aspect, the awakening aspect. We don't point to that as directly. And then on the other hand, again, Zen, this is all generalizations and has lots of exceptions, tends to point much more directly toward that transcendence, that awakening. There's this is a direct, that's the sense that things are pointing toward. And there's less emphasis on the skillful means. Kind of a stereotypical experience is like as a Zen student, you're just told to sit there and practice until you're awakened. You know, there's some instructions, but they're fairly light. Well, we're going to walk you through how to notice your breath and how to work with thought and all these different nuances. One teacher described that a good Vipassana talk, at the end, everything's completely clear. At the end of a good Zen talk, everything's completely confused. So it's part of, is like the way they point is a very different way. Their point is something else. And so that's one of the reasons, you know, I wanted to use these pictures is to help us as Western Vipassana students to learn to orient toward that transcendence, toward that emptiness, to the potential of our practice. That Zen does such a beautiful job of pointing toward that. And again, there's that big caveat that this may not be where you are in your practice. And wherever you are, whether you've been practicing for a few weeks or for a few decades, it's important to notice, okay, where am I? What's right in front of me? What's the place that allows my practice to really engage? And we'll explore this a little bit tonight and also around the homework. So I'm going to read the verse first. And I actually have a couple translations because I found two that were different enough, they help to inform each other. So this first one is one that was a series that Rodney Smith, you know, back, I don't know how many years now, it's probably 10, 15 years ago. So returning to the source. Having returned to the source, effort is over. The intimate self sees nothing outside, hears nothing outside. Still, the endless river flows tranquilly on. The flowers are red. Right? So it's very mystical. It's very, you know, there's a lot of power in that, but it's also maybe a little hard to understand. So we'll go through it line by line a little bit later tonight. The other translation, the one we have on our website, there's two titles, Return to the Origin, Back to the Source. Too many steps have been taken, returning to the root and the source. Better to have been blind and deaf from the beginning, dwelling in one's true abode, unconcerned with and without. The river flows tranquilly and the flowers are red. So we'll unpack that a little bit. But first, I want to look at this verse and this picture. We'll talk about the picture in just a little bit in context with the rest of the pictures. So again, if you're just kind of joining us now, each of these pictures depicts a stage, if you will, or a phase in the spiritual journey. At least one way it can unfold. And it's really a process of deepening all the way through. So the first five pictures, those ones we can really relate to, you know, as practitioners just off the street. You know, we're learning how to search, how to find skill, how to learn, and trying to feel that sense of suffering, that sense of lack in ourselves. Okay, there's something about this process or the spiritual path that draws us. Somehow we see that is going to provide some solution to that. And then we undertake a training of our minds, of our attention, of our bodies. And how do we sit still? How do we be upright? How do we work with our intentionality? We're really developing those first five pictures, concentration and cultivating insight. And as we all know, that process is often not the smoothest, that our minds are so trained to be distracted, to be going this way and that. And it takes a while to learn to steady the attention. It takes a while to learn to work skillfully with those contractions of our heart, of our mind. It's a process. And that's depicted in these first pictures of the searching for the ox and struggling with the ox, trying to catch the ox, trying to finally tame the ox. And the ox representing both our true nature and also the process of training itself. And then there's this important shift that when we actually develop this level of mastery within our practice, we've trained our minds enough, that we've cleaned up enough of the delusion, we've seen through it, our ignorance, we've learned to see more clearly how things actually are. We've learned to work with our reactivity. There's a certain momentum of our wisdom, of our compassion through insights, that we become this stage of sometimes what's called effortless effort, that the effort is very smooth, very easy. And we know this in other areas of our life. Someone who's, for example, a really good skier, it doesn't take much for them to just gracefully move down the slopes. Just a little bit of force at the right time does the perfect turn. Well, if early on when they first learned, you know, it was much more force, much more chaotic. It's the same thing with our practice. We learn how to have just that right amount of effort at the right time. So we start to learn how to listen to ourselves, to listen to the effects of our technique, of our approach, and we learn how to fine tune that. That's one of the big thing we do as teachers is try to help students discover that skill, how to fine tune, how to learn to really, you know, be appropriate with how their minds are in that moment. And not to struggle. So there's this effortless effort. So then that's the riding the ox home. the sense of connection, the sense of unity. And there's still a sense of us being in charge, of us being aligned in the path. We really, okay, I feel like I know what I'm doing here. I feel like, okay, I've arrived. And then the ox herding pictures throw a curveball on us, takes our rug out of our feet, and the ox is forgotten. The ox falls away, and there's this resting in peace and ease. So we spend all this time striving to find the ox. And once we master it, then the ox can be released. That sense of separation, that sense of effort. And then the next picture, when this ox is forgotten and the self is forgotten, there's an intensity, a deeper opening, starting to see through more and more. As I talked about last month, this echolocation, how we use our thoughts and our projections to bounce off other people and other things and really relocate not only them, but more importantly, us in relationship to that. I have an opinion about you, so therefore I know who I am as much as I know who you are. When the echolocation starts to break down and fall away through our practice, and we start to actually see other people, see life, see ourselves without reinforcing that echo of I, of me, of self. In the last month, the picture of the Enzo, this famous Zen circle, drawn in one brushstroke. Really, it's a powerful image. It's a powerful vision of this sense of stillness and emptiness, form and emptiness portrayed together. There's a lot of power in this shift, this shift of perception. There's a lot of power. There's a lot of immensity. Things just seem like so much vaster than we ever thought they could be. That sense of separation is falling away. And there's this charge, it's almost a release that we used to put ourselves into separation is released into this opening. And the description from last month really point to that. There's this fire, images of fire and you know, the vast sky. And then there's this picture. Now we come to this picture. So this image, I'm going to throw it up. I'm going to just stop my video so you can see. Let's make sure there's no. All right, someone said the picture is number 998. It's number 9? That's right, it's number 9. Yes. Okay, so picture number 9. So this picture, this image here, the one, there's a line, you can see me there. Hopefully, as I'm talking. And then online, you know, here in person, you can see it. You know, just it's an image that you got a trunk, you got of a tree or a bush, you got some gentle branches and leaves. And when I look at this compared to all these other images, it's the least striking of all of them. It's just kind of an ordinary kind of image. You know, we're used to all this drama of the struggle with the ox and finding the ox, the thrill of seeing the ox. Last month, seeing the striking image of the Enzo, that circle. You know, so this image is really not as central point of focus. It's really of an ordinary scene of nature, something that it's easy to overlook. And maybe that's part of the teachings of this picture, this image, that this is pointing to something that is we usually just overlook because we're so obsessed with the drama of our lives. Because the title of this is Returning to the Source, Returning to How Things Actually Are. It's like what we see when we start to, what's revealed when we release our fixation on form, release our fixation on the details of I, me, and mine. It's really pointing to what's beyond duality. A duality that's, some of you are very familiar with that, others perhaps not. There's a big part of spiritual traditions around duality and non-duality. Okay, non-duality is when we see through the assumed separation of self and others, the primary one. And we look out, that's our ordinary way of seeing it. There's always duality. I see there's me, and then there's you. There's this object outside of me. This picture is pointing to that falling away, that separation. So we're starting to get into some of the mystical aspects of Buddhism. Dogen said it this way: to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. Right? So that's a phrase. It's interesting to read that over and over again, because this picture is really pointing to that. That we've become actualized by myriad things. So suddenly there's not a sense of one thing in me. It's like everything starts to open. We open to everything. And then the body and mind, as well as the body and minds of others, drop away. There's no trace of that separation. And even the idea of enlightenment, even the concept of enlightenment, that also falls away. No trace of enlightenment remains. And this no trace continues endlessly. You know, pointing to the deathless, the unconditioned that the Buddha discovered. Again, we're getting into really deep Dharma here, so strap on your seatbelts as we go along here. Now, this might be a little, being a heretic, but I look at spiritual traditions as many of them, if not all of them, are pointing to the same thing. There's different ways of expressing it and interpreting it. But there's the same essence that I sense as I read them. So one of my favorite Christian mystics from the 6th century, I believe, Meister Eckhart. So not Eckhart Tolle, but Meister Eckhart, a Christian mystic who was considered a heretic because he just really talked about the experience of God, and even was also quite a feminist at the time, too. And Narayan told me I should give trigger warnings if I use the word God, because I know some of us have a lot of charge around it. My parents decided, we never went to church growing up, so I have a very neutral relationship to it. And I hold God as being the depth of spirituality. So I would use, that's how I'm interpreting it, not to use how it's often used to create harm, unfortunately. But anyway, Meister Eckhart, this is the way he described the same thing. How should one love God? Was the question he was answering. One should love God mindlessly, meaning that your soul ought to be without mind or mental activities or images or representations. Bear your soul of all mind. Stay there without mind. Let your own being you sink away and melt into God's being God. In this way, your you and God's her will become a completely one my. And you will come to know her changeless existence and her nameless nothingness. I mean, he sounds like a Zen teacher there. You know, he's pointing to something that's beyond our normal way of interpreting. One teacher described, like Zen koans, they ask us to shift out of our normal way of perceiving, our normal way of thinking, of understanding. Because if we try to use it from our normal perspective, it seems like it's crazy talk. This doesn't make any sense. So it asks us to see what perspective would this actually be true? What perspective would this actually resonate? This is very, very deep Dharma. And then finally, the last picture, number 10 in this 10 series, is around integration of how do we take the depth of our insight back into our daily lives to come into the marketplace. So this is kind of, this month is kind of the depth of it. And then next month we say, okay, how do you actually bring that in to our lives? And I think that would be much more accessible because however our insights have grown, we can learn how to apply them, how to have them show up in our lives. So classically, this is how the spiritual journey can be laid out, at least again, one expression of it, that we practice, practice, practice. There's insight, there's realization. We practice some more. There's a deeper realization. Practice, there's a complete realization or a more complete realization. I think it's helpful not to say, okay, I've arrived, this is the end of the story. There's always a deepening that is possible. And there's the integration back into our lives. So the way these pictures depict it is that we kind of go through a bunch of practice. We see things more clearly. It changes us in a profound way. And then we take that change back into our lives. But for most of us, the integration period, that last picture actually happens as we go along. In fact, it's very helpful for it to do that. That we grow, we have this sense of stability. Helps us keep us grounded in our lives. Because if we all went off and became monks and nuns for 10 or 20 years and came back into life, it would be a little bit rocky. How do we reintegrate? How do we have a job? How do we feed ourselves? How do we have relationships? Because we had devoted so much time to seeing clearly. Now, if you're drawn to do that, I'm not negating that in any way. But I think people who are drawn to it do, you know, admit that it is hard to integrate. It's just a longer process. Ram Dass said that if you think you're enlightened, go and spend a week with your family. You know? And it's like that's very true. It's like when we're around like-minded people, it's like we go home and it's like our practice just goes out the window. And that's pointing to this gap between our understanding and the integration, and that gap. So before diving into these verses line by line, I want to take a moment to look at that integration. So last Friday night, we had a visiting teacher, Judith Radger, who's a Zen teacher. She's been practicing Zen for some 50 years and teaching for about 17 years or so. And I was lucky enough to be able to attend her talk. And you know, I found it a very helpful perspective because her point was that Buddhism, and I think particularly Zen, has a certain bias toward the emptiness, to this liberation. And we tend to discount the story. We say, okay, let go of the story, let go of the details. I mean, I'm teaching an intro class right now, and that's what I say all the time, is learning how to let go of the story in order to develop that steadiness of attention, that concentration, because we're so enmeshed with that story. But she was realizing in her own practice that those instructions only take us so far, that we can feel like we have a deep sense of understanding and liberation, and yet when we go to spend a week with our family, everything falls apart. And so her message was that we need to learn to attend to our stories, actually turn toward them, to meet them fully without resistance, to actually see them in a very deep way, to the point that we can see them, in the heart of them is actually emptiness. She talked about it as being this digestion of the story. We learn to digest it, to kind of mull it over, to dive into it, to use other modalities like psychotherapy, to use things like 12 steps if we have trouble with addiction, ways to help to kind of give us a set of feedback, a sense of structure and support to go into these deep areas. So I'm meeting it until it's digested, mostly digested, the story of our personal life, the story of our trauma, of our abuse, the story of our oppression. You know, if we're a marginalized person, if we're Black or Indigenous, Asian, whatever it might be, if we're a non-binary person, if we're not a heterosexual person, there's all these ways that we are marginalized in our culture. And that carries a weight. The intergenerational story, as she spoke of people of Jewish descent and how there's a trauma that's in their DNA. All these things, it's helpful to learn to turn toward and meet those. So I think it's important to dovetail any talk about emptiness to realize that we also have to learn to work with the story. So we're not turning away from the story or avoiding it, because we can get very good at how to kind of make the story vanish, at least appears to vanish, by going into a state of concentration, going to a state of insight. Things just, okay, suddenly that story doesn't matter anymore, right? And that's a very important perspective. And yet, sometimes that perspective is kind of a false refuge. We've kind of used our practice as a way to avoid the spiritual bypassing. One teacher described that the way, or maybe this is just a Zen saying, the way to nirvana, is through samsara. It's not the difficulty of our life prevents us from awakening. It's actually going into that and seeing the emptiness of itself. And so we need to learn when the story needs to be attended to, when it needs to be explored and met with wisdom and compassion. And when does it need to be released? When do we need to see through it? Something my rule of thumb is that whatever your tendency is, you're going to grow more going opposite of that. Okay, so if your tendency is like, I'm an enlightenment or bust, you know, I'm just going to go right to the emptiness. I'm not going to story. I'm just going to release all that stuff, go right into that. If you're like that, you're going to learn more by going into the emptiness. I mean, not to emptiness, but into the story, learning to meet that personal pain, turning toward the pain body, as Eckhart Tolle spoke of. On the other hand, if we find ourselves just always in the story with never any perspective, any space, opening to emptiness is a way of growth. So just, I offer that to just notice for yourself, you know, where is our bias? Where is our tendency? I was talking to my wife about the Enneagram, you know, when there's a way of kind of classifying, like you're a feeling type or a thinking type. And I'm not going to go into that too much because I'll get confused about it. But she said that was actually originally developed by Jung. And his model was that you see what kind of your natural tendency is, but instead of just staying there, the kind of one of the purposes of being a human being is to mature and to balance. To find, if you're a feeling type, learn to be a thinking type, and vice versa. So you have a fullness of being alive. It's the same thing with the story and emptiness. We learn to hold both of them equally, to hold the depth of the emptiness and to hold the very personalness of the story. And that way we become a mature person, a mature practitioner. And this is what I was going to the next month's picture, when the person, the Buddha-like creature, the person comes back, their chest is open, their heart is open. They're fully engaged in life. All right, so with that, let's go through some of the lines here with our time remaining. So again, there's these two verses or translations. So too many steps, returning to the origin, back to the source. Too many steps have been taken, returning to the root and the source. Better to have been blind and deaf from the beginning, dwelling in one's true abode, unconcerned with and without, the river flows tranquilly on. And the other verse, other translation, having returned to the source, effort is over. This, the intimate self sees nothing outside, hears nothing outside. Still, the endless river flows tranquilly on. The flowers are red. The flowers are red at the first, and also the first one. I dropped that when I cut and pasted here. All right, so the title, Return to the Origin, Back to the Source. This is really the theme of the whole image, the whole picture, really the whole process. And we've traveled so far. We've worked so hard. We've experienced so many different things. And at the end of that, we find ourselves back in our true nature, back to of the source, the origin. And there's a real sense of returning to something as opposed to obtaining something. I think our bias, as these pictures show, is we're always going out there to find, to seek. There's a deficiency in ourselves. Finding that ox, finding that technique that will fill that deficiency is our logic anyway. And this is the joke, is that once we actually find it, we realize, oh, this has actually always been here. Just something has obscured it. Something has covered it up. You know, there's always something that's seen in previous pictures. There's echoes of something outside of us, something beyond ourselves that we're seeking. In this picture, we realize, you know, it's always been here, covered up, obscured. And somehow all those steps we've taken have led back to us, ourselves, to what we really are. So the first line, too many steps have been taken, returning to the root and the source. Or, having returned to the source, effort is over. Now, times that I've had a significant shift in my understanding, a significant insight, and you know, reflecting on your own times, what I mean by that is like you really see things differently. You realize I was seeing things from a certain perspective, an assumption. And somehow through practice, through inquiry, through some event, I suddenly see life in a very, very different way. And when those happen to us, we often reflect, why did I make this so hard? Why was this so hard? This is so obvious. It's so clear right now how things actually are. How could I have been so confused, so utterly confused? Why did I struggle so much? Some of those times I've just felt a tremendous amount of sadness and grief at how much unnecessary suffering I caused myself. But it's also, there's a sweetness to it, because there's this, oh, it's like I finally have seen through that. This is the power of delusion, the power of our unconsciousness, the power of our ignorance, as I spoke of a little while, a few months or a few weeks ago, that we can't see through delusion. We can't see through it because of it's how much it blinds us. It keeps us from seeing clearly, from sensing clearly, from knowing clearly. I often use, you know, seeing and blindness not as a, you know, statement around that sense. You know, I know some of us can't see very well or can't see at all. It's really that sense of knowing is what I'm pointing toward. We just beat our heads against it, trying it, pleading. We try forcing. We try giving up. We try this technique and that. But until that shift happens, we're really lost in that delusion. So many steps have been taken, returning to the root and the source. Then the next lines, better to have been blind and deaf from the beginning, dwelling in one's true abode, unconcerned with and without. And the other translation, the intimate self sees nothing outside, hears nothing outside. Okay, these are little different translations, but they really are pointing to the same thing. And this is the falling away of separation. So this is just check in for a second on how you're perceiving your environment, how you're perceiving the words or whatever is in front of you, your eyes. There's a sense of that being outside of yourself. Okay, I see you, I see you, I see this, I hear this. There's me hearing something that's just outside of that, what's perceiving. This picture is pointing to how that falls away. There's no sense of something being outside, nothing's being seen or heard outside, because our thing is, there's outside and inside falls away. Okay, this is a really big opening of that perception of self. It falls away. There's no separation. So the famous sutta advice to Bahia from the Buddha. So Bahia was this very sincere, had a lot of urgency in practice, but he was also not seeing. He was practicing in a way that wasn't so helpful. And the Buddha felt his intensity, his urgency, and just laid it out here. So then Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will only be the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. Okay, so in all the senses, just what's being seen. Not you who's seeing that. Okay, that's how you should train yourself. For you, there will only be the seen in reference to the seen, etc. The heard in reference to the heard. Then, Bahia, this is the important piece. There is no you in connection to that. When there's no you in connection with that, there is no you there. When there's no you there, you're neither here nor yonder, nor between the two. This is the end of dukkha. And this is really asking us to go beyond our normal perspective. So if it's confusing, just hold that. Okay, what does that mean, that lack of separation? No need to form any idea around it, no concept around it. Just hold it as that mystery. Then hopefully your heart will start to yearn to seeing. And then near the end, the river flows tranquilly on, or still the endless river flows tranquilly on. So this is from this state of non-duality, of non-separation, life just keeps flowing. You know, like you've changed completely. But life still does its thing. It still comes and goes. This arises, this passes. And there's this harmony in that. There's this observation of it. Usually we try to fix that river, try to make it stay static, try to hurry it along for those things we don't like. And then finally, the last line, the flowers are red. The flowers are red. Now, this line, to be honest, that's the one I'm the least clear about what that means. You know, in Chinese culture, red is a very prestigious, or not prestigious, what do they call it? It's a very important color because it represents luck, joy, happiness, also of fire. So it's often used for celebration, for vitality, fertility. And so in that culture from which, you know, these paintings come from, it's like those flowers are red is pointing to this auspicious, was the word I was looking for, the auspiciousness of that the flowers are red, that there's something significant is here. And that leads into the next picture, the next image, the final image. So these images, it really points to some deep dharma. And this image here, there's a level of falling away that is, it's hard to talk about, it's hard to explain, and yet that's what the practice points to. So I encourage you, when you're listening to Dharma talks, or when you're listening to reading suttas, when you're reading Dharma books, notice where that stillness is. You know, sometimes it's kind of covered up, or sometimes it's obscured, but sometimes it just kind of comes right forth and you see, okay, that's what it's pointing to. And in Zen, it's like becomes, that's, I think, one of the, you know, as Buddhism went through different countries and different regions, different cultures, it got transformed based on that culture. And each culture adds its own elements, its own wisdom, its own way of integrating it. And when it got to China and to Japan and Korea and became what's called Zen in Vietnam, it has this direct pointing that's so precious. So using that pointing to orient our practice, and at the same time also realizing we do have to attend to our lives. We do have to meet ourselves. And that's what the homework is all about. So I'll unpack that in a moment or two, but let's just sit quietly for a little bit, letting those words settle. And as we sit, letting what's always here to come forth, that stillness, the lack of separation. Gently, without any friction, releasing the forms of life. Letting that stillness envelop to touch all things. And in that touching, releasing all separation. All right. Thank you. I know that kind of went out there, but that's the picture this month is out there. So hopefully we can through our discussions, through your questions, we can try to make it have some sense, some connection. And so my attempt for that is with the homework. And Ken, if you could throw that up on the chat for the people online again, and those in person, there should be plenty of copies over there. So returning to the source. So reflect on emptiness and form. So this picture points to a profound aspect of emptiness. This is a very deep, perhaps the deepest aspect of our practice. And how does emptiness relate to form, particularly our story? Sometimes I think of it this way, that our emptiness can hold the story. But the story doesn't do a good job of holding emptiness. Like it doesn't make the story, from the story's perspective, from the complete enmeshment in the story, emptiness does not make any sense. All this stuff that I talked about today just is crazy talk. But from the perspective of emptiness, when it's matured and when it's really unbiased, a form can be held equally and easily in the midst of that. And that's really our task as we mature in our practice. So can the story be sustained in emptiness? Right? So that's a question, because I think, and notice this, don't take my word for it, because in some ways the story can't be sustained. We can find a way of connecting to emptiness that the story just vanishes, falls away. And there's another way that emptiness can be held, that actually the story can be sustained, but with that perspective of emptiness. But from that first way, the way that we see it and it just falls away, is this always a beneficial thing? Because the story contains our pain, right? It contains our sorrows, our griefs. Isn't it so nice to just always to release that? But is that always completely beneficial? Are there times the story needs to be deeply understood and felt? And what guides our choice? To open to emptiness, to open the story? Is that guided by our wisdom, by our ignorance, by our preference? Just to reflect, these are big questions. And try to reflect it not from an abstract way, but actually next time you spend a week with your family or whatever triggers you, see if you can take a few minutes just to sit and notice, okay, there's the story perspective when I get completely lost in it. No separation, no sense of, say, not so much no separation, but no sense of perspective. It's completely lost in that. Emotions and thoughts just are buffeted by that. And then notice how you can go into that place of grounding, stillness, and the story loses its grip on you. There's this place where you can see that the right balance. There's a place where we can actually kind of numb ourselves or disconnect. Right? So we're pointing to something, you know, that Judith Ragar talked about, and I encourage you to listen to her talk when it gets on the website. It's an important perspective, you know, finding that balance, finding that way through. All right, so next week I'll be back and we can explore that homework and anything else that comes up around this topic for you. But right now, let's see if you have any questions or sharing you like to do. So online, if you'd like to just raise your virtual hand and I can call on you. And in person, if you don't mind coming over to the hot seat. Come on up, Deb. That just allows those online to hear. Oops.
I was thinking about the stories that you were commenting on. And I have a couple of reflections to share that are just recent in my life about stories. One is about my thinking about as a white person in this country. And I just finished reading the book called Caste, C-A-S-T-E, by Isabel Wilkerson. And she recounts lots and lots of history about Black people here in America. And I have to say that heretofore, fairly recently, I think I probably was raised, acculturized to dismiss a lot of those stories. Complaining. And then I read that book and I've read a few other books. And I am bowled over by my ignorance and how I don't know these stories. And I cannot imagine and never will imagine the weight of what those stories are on the backs of people who carry them, as well as my own stories as a white person, you know, and my suffering as a white person. So that's just one comment that we can talk a lot about here, but I won't, but I just wanted to comment on that. I just have to sit back on my heels and say, what delusion have I been under? It's a big one, that story. And then just today, I got word from a reliable third party about a friend of ours who I've had stories about this person. She's this way. She's that way. She's this way. Well, you know, she's this way. You know, she's just like that. And we all have other stories about people. But the information that I got today was that she was just recently given a diagnosis of breast cancer. Early stage, but breast cancer. She's about my age. I had to sit back on my heels. And all of a sudden, this kind of delusion of like, well, who is she? Who am I? You know, that separateness. And I began to think, oh, yeah, it's that boundary that we all come to somehow or other. You know, that death comes to all of us. I don't know if she's going to die of this, but it's such a scary thing to say breast cancer. And I found myself thinking, well, how would I handle this? How would I react? Will I react that way? What's going to come to me? And all of the ideas that I had about, well, you know, she's this way, she's that way, it just sort of evaporated. It really kind of doesn't matter, you know, anymore. The humanity of all of us is so apparent in those moments. It kind of like, it's like one of those moments where I see through that curtain the divisions. Yeah. We all come to this somehow. How will I come there? How does she come there? All of us, you know, it was so profound. And the house, my husband came home and told me this, you know, and we're usually very talkative with one another, and we kind of weren't for a while. It just got really quiet. We're thinking about this, you know. So I was just thinking about that as you were speaking tonight. Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Deb. Just hang out there for a second in case there's any follow-up. So just to respond. So you can all hear okay? Yeah, good. You know, I mean, that's a great way. You really described a beautiful way of meeting the story and seeing it, acknowledging it. You know, the two examples of the systemic system of racism and how we hold people, you know, that's invisible caste is invisible to us as white people. It's not invisible at all to those who are not white. And you don't have to, I mean, that's the reality. It's very obvious to those who are oppressed by racism how strong that force is. But as white people, we have our privilege that we can just kind of ignore that and we can dismiss the story. So that courage to do the study, to do the work, to question, that's that turning toward that belief in that story, or the absence, you know, the negation of that story, to actually listen, to actually take it into our hearts. And it's very painful to really take it in that way, but it's needed. That's the exact example of what I was trying to point to, is that. And what makes that possible is the willingness to loosen that story of my own perspective, my own defensiveness. Because you could have stayed, like as many of us said, as a white person, as we have this defensiveness, that white fragility, that pushing away. But something has softened in you that's fallen away. And you're able to actually open to the story in a very deep way and let that affect you. There's one, I forget who said this, or some teacher quoted that we're not here to change the world. The world is here to change us. And that's an example of hearing the story. And then the personal story, the personal, the friend and the gossip and the way we hold that person contained and our idea of that and how that just gets shattered by this moment of the mortality, the shared predicament of mortality. And then that story falls away and there's that connection. And so it all points to how do we find that connection? How do we find that sense of our hearts? That's kind of the bottom line. Can our hearts be fully engaged in the pain of the world? Yeah. Thank you, Deb. All right. See if there's anyone online who'd like to share anything. All right, Cheryl, come on down.
Hello. On camera here. I heard a Dharma talk on Saturday morning given by a couple of Chinese monks. And it was about metta. It was surprising. It was a surprising talk from them. And they're an organization in their monastery needed help, so they got help from some, I can't remember who it was, maybe somebody from Abai Giri. Mm-hmm. And what the message was they needed metta. They needed metta. And And then they showed, then there was, you know, talk, a lot of talk about metta, kind of, you know, bringing it into life and that, you know, not just being the phrases and all that, but really, you know, like one said, you know, he was Polish and he, when he was 10, he would go to visit his grandmother and he would remember that feeling of being with his grandmother and being in her house and being so loved. And then they showed this very powerful, like 5-minute intro to a program called GRIP that's being done at, I can't remember what GRIP stands for now, but that's being done at San Quentin. Hmm. And it's like a 52-week program with all the inmates. And the biggest thing that he asked this question, you know, why are you here? What do you think you're going to get from this program? And you know, a lot of people say to be a better person. And he said, if that's your motivation, if that's your intention, you leave the room and come back with a new intention. And really what it came down to, it was so beautiful because it's an area that I struggle with all the time, you know, not accepting. And it's like accepting the story, accepting it, and then being able to integrate it. But, you know, we're already better people. We're already okay as we are. And that's a really hard thing to take in because I never feel that way. But it's that acceptance. It's like metta as acceptance. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to, it was a powerful message for me and really for everybody in the room. There was, you know, just watching that video, you can't watch it and not sit there and cry. But it's I always thought, wow, it'd be great if we could, if that was available to non-inmates. I think it'd be an amazing program for anybody. So I just wanted to share that.
Great. Thank you, Cheryl. Yeah, that metta as acceptance, metta as that's turning toward. Yeah. I mean, that's...
There's one other thing. Yeah. Metta is unconditional. And there's something about metta is unconditional. Because when I'm trying to, like, you know, give metta to myself, when I'm really feeling down on myself, it doesn't feel unconditional. Everything feels conditional at that point.
Right.
And so it's you know, reminders and kind of that place. It's like sort of almost like it's so easy to forget this stuff. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I can say that's really the heart of it, is that the unconditional aspect or quality of metta of our attention. And it is we try to do that, but of course we hit that mirror of our own reactivity or self-belief. That's that echolocation I was talking about. It's like we see something, we think we're seeing it cleanly, but we're actually seeing it from our own, you know, our conditioning, our ignorance. And we can tell if we really tune in, sometimes it's really obvious by how our heart feels. If there's that contraction of heart, that anger, that hurt, it's like, oh, I'm coming from that. And so then that's where the practice is. Can I meet that? May I be with this to whatever degree I can? And then slowly over time, by meeting the story that way, it starts to lose our belief in it.
That digestion that she
was. Yeah, exactly. About. Yes.
Yeah, Judith's talk was really
good. Yes. All right. Thank you, Cheryl. All right. How about those online? Anyone like to share anything? All right. How about back in person? Anyone else like to share anything? Yes, Cuba.
I guess I'm thinking about what Cheryl said and the concept of metta, and that what you were saying, Tim, about things falling away sometimes. When I'm under stress, you know, when I'm in those belief systems that are erroneous, it always seems like, you know, like in daily life, there's only two choices. One is I'm wrong, and one is the other person's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And both are just so painful.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate what you've said, Tim. It's just, it's in that inquiry of what is my story happening here? About them, about me? Can I find some freedom and some curiosity? Like Deb said about, well, this person, I had a story about this person and she's suffering now. And then everything just shifts. And I had the thought when you and Cheryl were talking that that really is the meaning of compassion, isn't it?
Mm.
It's just no space anymore between us.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a nice definition. Mm. Anything else?
Nope. Right. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Okay. So let's see if I have any thoughts. Yeah, that what you said about that, when we're kind of caught in that reactivity, it feels like there's the two options, you're wrong or I'm wrong. And both are very painful. And that kind of sums up, I think we're all familiar with that mind state. We really get caught in that, you know, someone has to be to blame. It's either you or me or both of us. And that's when we call forth our practice, that there's this third option that really looks at the very premise that we're kind of holding everything on. You know, and from a very practical perspective, so much of it simply boils down to our willingness to turn toward suffering. You know, and that's the compassion, is that willingness to turn toward, to meet, to metta. You know, Christina Feldman talked about metta as this willingness to be next to turn toward. You know, and compassion is this asking what is needed. And when we do that, then what we let go of is our belief in the details, the story, if you will. We go from the details of one wrong, one right, who's wrong, to the pain that we're both sharing. And when we touch that pain, that's the potential for not only healing and not only resolution and moving forward, but also that's the interface of story and emptiness, right? Because the non-emptiness holds the details of the story as absolute. You're wrong or I'm wrong. But emptiness holds that, hey, there's pain here. Can I meet the pain? Yeah. So thank you, Kaba. All right, Kathy, go ahead.
Well, to Tim, this was a fantastically interesting talk for me on many levels, but the first one, it has to do with the fact that I'm going to spend 4 days with my sisters in a few weeks, and I haven't seen them for a few years, and that we're across a great range of politics and life views and et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to be a very interesting and different visit, because I think I'm hoping to carry some of this idea with me of non-separation, or at least to stay loose, stay open, stay. And I notice I have developed. I am aware of that more often as I, you know, continue with this practice. The other thing, though, that's you've pointed to it in a helpful way, is that I've always been a kind of an attainer and a achiever, goal setter, and you get there. And so returning rather than attaining, it has a lovely softness to it, and I'm hoping you'll give us some more guidance on that. I mean, these other two, the Cuba and Cheryl were kind of pointing to it and Deb with their compassion and their boundaries falling away, looking at another person. But just be interested in what you would have to say.
Yeah, thank you, Kathy. Yeah, that willingness to meet family in a different way, to come forth in a with our heart, with our connection. I mean, that's such an important intention of how do we really integrate our practice. And especially with family, you know, it's like that's where a lot of our wounding was learned, where it was first given. And there's just this whole dynamic of family that's kind of set up to kind of trigger it. You know, it doesn't make sense except from just that's how this family kind of developed. And so a lot of it is that just that capacity to be willing to hold our pain, to actually touch it. And that's why it's, you know, the very basic instructions, like learning how to sit still and not move with every itch and move with every, you know, ache or pain. We're learning that capacity to hold our physical pain. You know, again, we have the discernment about when we need to change, but usually we move so much sooner. But learning how to relax with it, to meet it, be curious, that becomes a template for our emotional pain. You know, and just when you go in, you go home, or you go with your family, your sisters, it's like that pain is it's emotional. It's so charged, and the impulse to act on that, to react to it, is also hardwired in. So bringing that quality of pause, that quality of okay, let me just see, let me feel that, let me have that quality of compassion, and let yourself be. I think it's really helpful to kind of try to let go of your assumptions. Like Deb was talking about the friend and all the story that's built up. We built a lot of stories around our siblings, right? That's who we are, who they are. Let all that go. Let them be fresh. Let yourself be fresh in that. Because I think what happens, we just kind of load up our, okay, I'm into my family mode, and I don't even realize I'm operating from that assumption. Right, that's loaded right up. So then it's really hard to deviate from that. But once if there was no assumptions of how I would show up, I have no idea how I'm going to act. All I know is I'm going to try to hold whatever arises with as much compassion and kindness as I can. And that turning toward with metta, with compassion, then seeing, okay, what comes from that? What action comes from that? And then there's a kind of reaction, and you keep dancing with that. Yeah. So thank you, Kathy. I wish you luck with that. It's you can really learn a lot. It's really good to bring a lot of curiosity, interest. Well, what is it going to be like when my sister says that thing that always triggers me? Well, it's going to be curious. What happens? And let yourself be surprised, and let them be different than you expect. You might be surprised how different they can be just by you being different. The dynamic just, it seems so entrenched, but it can actually become very fluid if we just release that fixation around it. All right. Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you, Tim.
All right. Thank you all for your engagement and your willingness to turn toward the Dharma. It benefits not only yourselves, but benefits everyone, benefits all beings. So thank you for that dedication. And you're welcome to say goodbye, and you can help us wrap things up here. That'd be wonderful.